All right, we're going to get started in just a minute. We're ready now. Okay. If I could have everyone in their seats, we're going to get started. Good morning. I'm Jane Batty, chair of the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board. And I want to welcome everyone to our meeting today. We'll call the board, the roll for the board in just a minute, but I want to welcome you back to the building here for our hybrid, both in-person and a remote June board meeting. It's always great to see everyone in the room. So thanks for being here with us. As a reminder, in addition to in-person participants for the meeting, we can receive public comments through our Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to comment or think you might be interested in commenting, whether you are in person or remote, we ask that you register online for our meeting today so we know that you'd like to speak and we can call on you. For our remote speakers, if you have not already received a link to the Zoom meeting, please visit our website and register via the agenda for today's meeting. You will not be able to participate via the live webcast, but only through the Zoom service. So make sure you're connected to Zoom. If you're here in person, you can either register online or through the front desk here at the meeting. For those of you on Zoom who probably know this by now, you'll be on mute until it is your turn to speak. We'll unmute you, and then it often takes a second or two to connect. And then we look forward to your comments. When you're done speaking and the board members have completed any questions, you'll be placed back on mute. For those in the auditorium waiting to speak, you'll be called by name when it's your turn to speak. And please come down to the podium here so we can all hear you. For all our speakers, when you come to speak to us, if you could, please give us your name and your affiliate organization, if that's applicable. Again, we thank everyone for their participation in the meeting. Julie, while I figure out how to talk, I'm going to turn it over to you and have you call the roll.
Not yet.
Am I live?
There you go.
All right.
Good morning, Julie.
Board Member Beelin is absent. Board Member Young.
Here.
Board Member Gunther.
Here.
Board Member Kissinger.
Here.
Vice Chair Hacker.
Here.
And Chair Batty.
Here. We have a quorum today, and thanks everyone for being here. We're going to now go on to agenda item 2, which is our public forum. We have a couple of speakers today, and Julie's going to help me. I have just one listed, which is Bill McNichols.
Yes, we also have Save the Bay.
Save the Bay. Great. Wonderful. Let's start with Bill. Bill is on Zoom, I suspect. Good morning, Bill. Are you there?
I am here. Good morning, Madam President, Board of Directors, Executive Officer, and staff. I'm Bill McNichols from Cleanup Marinewood Plaza Now Oversight Committee. Once again, I have to start off with, I had an Stephen Nestle, who can't be here this morning, and myself had an excellent discussion with Alec Noggle. I think that's how you pronounce the last name, if I have it correct. Talking what's going on and bringing it up to date on the whole thing. And he told us the plans that are now in place to move forward. But I've heard this for the past how many years, at least since the wrap, you know, it keeps coming out, new orders and everything. But if he sounds very positive, I'm going to look positively on this. And Stephen agrees. We want to see it happen. Hopefully the discharger will continue. We'll move forward with the son now in charge on moving on this project. One item, though, that I did discover on GeoTracker, that we had the Union 76 site, which was cleaned up years ago, has disappeared from GeoTracker. And on that site, the project manager had stated the property was not suited for residential housing. But that has all disappeared. I remember it's been a few years ago that one of our committee members, who has since passed, came out and found a document, which we went back to the site that stated that. It was missing from the site, and we brought it to the board. And the next day, it appeared back up on the site. But now the site has disappeared, which we strongly feel is critical in this whole thing, if any development's going to be done down there, and needs to be taken a look at and restated. I haven't had the time to go back in and look to see if I have a copy of that letter, but I could go through Ray Day's files that I still have some, and on my files, and see what I can find. And Alec is working on that this week to get us an answer and find out what happened. I thank you for this time.
Thank you, Bill. We appreciate you coming to speak to us.
Madam Chair, I made a mistake. It's actually Eric Boucher from SF Baykeeper.
Okay, no problem. We'll get there in just a second. Bill, I just, again, thank you for being here today. I wanted to point out that in the executive officer's report this month, there's an excellent report on the cleanup program and the performance of that team, which is handling hundreds of sites around the Bay. So appreciate all the attention that's been given to Marinwood, but also appreciate our staff that is pedaling as hard as they can to keep up with all these sites. So thank you very much both to Bill and to our staff for all their work. All right, I'm going to move on to Baykeeper now. Who is here in person or on Zoom, Julie? On Zoom.
On Zoom.
Great. Welcome. Oh, hi, Eric. Nice to see you.
You as well. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Batty, the board, executive officer, and staff for your time today. Last fall, my colleague Ian Wren spoke here about selenium pollution in relation to the NPDES permit for Martinez Refining Company. And while Baykeeper had asked that the board reject the permit and adopt one with a stricter environmentally protective limits on selenium discharges, the board's addition of reporting requirements in that NPDES permit in response to our comments was a step in the right direction. On June 1st, Martinez submitted their report on selenium reduction measures. That report demonstrates the need for follow through on that initial step in order to obtain a robust and science-based set of analyses for implementing selenium reduction measures in the future as part of the triennial review, rulemaking, or other NPDES permitting processes. That report also tells us that in 2019, Martinez exceeded its TMDL allocation for selenium. And then throughout 2020, its selenium discharges were higher than they had been in 2019. So in 2020, the regional board asked Martinez to report on those discharges in ways to reduce them. In October of 2020, Martinez provided information to the board and installed a sand filter. And in 2021, the discharges were lower than they had been in the prior 2 years. But that was fool's gold. Martinez selenium discharges in 2022 were the highest levels going back to at least 2017, exceeding its TMDL allocation for the third time in 4 years. And because of the report that this board required, we now know that the selenium reduction in 2021 had nothing to do with the sand filter or other actions from Martinez, but instead was because the crude oil being processed had less selenium in it. So rather than simply accept the report's assurances that actions are being taken and money is being spent, or the report's demonstrated lower discharges of selenium in 2023, the board should continue to demand further study and information from Martinez so that history does not repeat itself. But two other things are fundamentally required to make sure that the follow-through on this positive first step results in meaningful progress. First, the board should gather more information from the other refineries who also have selenium load allocations under the TMDL. There's no reason the scientific record and analysis should come only from Martinez, just like there's no reason that actions to reduce selenium discharges should only be taken by Martinez. The board has authority under state law to request this information from the other refineries, and given the demonstrated utility of the report already provided by Martinez, it should do so. And second, the board then needs to leverage that information to force selenium load reductions in the future. The impacts of allowing unsustainable amounts of pollution in San Francisco Bay, be it selenium or a host of other harmful pollutants, will be devastating and potentially irreversible, but avoiding those impacts by smart action now is doable. I again want to thank the board for this first step and encourage the board to continue down this path to ensure that the refineries, not just Martinez, provide actionable information so that selenium pollution can be reduced in San Francisco Bay in the future. I'd like to thank the board again for the time, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Eric, thank you very much. Can I just comment also, Eric, you've come before this board several times and you are a pro at making your 3 minutes really, really effective. So hats off to you. I wanna, and truly we appreciate your comments and your participation in our work. Eileen, I'm gonna pass it to you because we have already taken some actions.
Yeah, so I also wanna thank Baykeeper for their comments. We at the Water Board were also disappointed with the Martinez Refinery submittal that we received. And so we are following up with them to get more information and more studies, and we'll be reporting back to our board as we promised this fall.
Great, thank you very much. Any questions for clarification from the board on this one? No, okay, great. Okay, Andy wants to ask questions, but he's gonna hold them until we get more of a report, just to share that. All right, thank you. I just wanna confirm no other speakers. We're good, Julie says. All right, let's go on to item 3, which is our minutes of our May board meeting, which I think is the first board meeting I've missed in a long time. So thank you to Alexis and the team for filling in for me. I do want to mention that I was able to, because of our great technology, watch the entire board meeting on the recording, which are very effective. I practically felt like I was there. So thank you all again for that. All right, so we want to do approval of the minutes. There are two minor edits that are being made to the minutes. First on page 1, oversight, O-V-E-R-S-I-T-E, should be oversight with S-I-G-H-T, and on page 3, core should be C-O-R-P-S. So we got both those small changes. And so just with a show of hands, as I understand it, with these corrections, we can just approve this by hand vote. So anyone opposed? I'm gonna abstain because I was not at the meeting. And can I get agreement to approve the minutes by show of hands? Great, wonderful. The minutes pass. I'm gonna move on to the swearing in now. And I will read this to everyone. Before we proceed with the hearing for our board items today, I'll read the oath. All relevant evidence that any person desires to be considered by this board must be introduced at this hearing first by the board staff, second by the discharger, third by public agencies, and fourth by any other interested parties. The board and board counsel may ask questions to clarify the testimony of a witness at any time. Cross-examination of any witness by others will be allowed following completion of direct testimony by all persons. Each person testifying will commence by stating his or her name, whom he or she represents, and whether she or he took the oath to tell the truth. The hearings will not be conducted according to technical rules of evidence. The board will accept any evidence or testimony that is reasonably relevant to the issues. All board files, exhibits, and agenda materials pertaining to this matter will be made part of the record of this process. Additional written materials will be made part of the record at the discretion of the board. Those wishing to testify in the hearing will now rise or raise their hand. Do you promise to tell the truth? Thank you. And now, Eileen, I'm going to hand it over to you for item 4, the uncontested items.
Great, thank you. So we have 3 MPDS permits before you. They're all uncontested. I'll just briefly describe. The first one is the general waste discharge requirements for discharges from the dry docks operation. And this revised Senate order would reissue the MPDS permit that regulates discharges associated with floating dry docks used for repairing, constructing, and dismantling marine vessels. The most significant change from the previous orders is that the revised Senate order contains more stringent sediment monitoring and reporting requirements. And then the second permit that's uncontested is with the city of Pinole and for the Pinole Hercules Water Pollution Control Plant and Wastewater Collection System. This tentative order would reissue the MPDS permit for the city of Pinole's wastewater treatment plant and collection system and would continue to allow the city to discharge secondary treated wastewater to San Pablo Bay while updating requirements to reflect recent regulatory changes. The most significant difference between the tentative order and the previous order is that it would include the new toxicity requirements that were approved by EPA on May 1st of this year. And then the last one, the Pittsburgh owner for the Pittsburgh Generation Station, this revised tentative order is going to rescind the individual MPDS permit for the former Pittsburgh Generation Station. The permit's no longer necessary because the facility is decommissioned and no longer generates processed wastewater. So we are recommending the board adopt all three MPDS permits with one change. In the dry docks tentative order, we would like to change the deadline for the sediment stressor identification report required in monitoring reporting program section 7.3 on page E13 of the tentative order from October 1st, 2027 to January 5th, 2028. This would be consistent with our response to comments and the change we made to monitoring reporting program table E5. So with that one change, we recommend you adopt all three.
Before I ask for a motion on this, are there any questions from the board? Hold on, yeah, one second. Yeah, and Alexis, and okay, go ahead.
Just very quickly, a facility of the size and location of the PG&E generating station would also have the potential to generate contaminated runoff anytime there's a rainstorm. And I mean, do they discharge into a facility that is covered by the MRP, and or would they have direct discharge to the bay given where they are?
And I'm going to let Bill answer that question.
Okay, the man with the info.
This is Bill Johnson. Oh, I thought it was off. Good morning, this is Bill Johnson. I head up the NPDS Wastewater Division. To answer your question, yes, they have runoff that is potentially polluted. And so the way the rescission is worded is that it goes into effect when they enroll for coverage under the Industrial Stormwater General Permit.
Great, thank you. Thanks. And Alexis. Member
Just
Hacker.
Some short questions. Under the dry dock operations, heretofore, we've had three facilities enrolled. Do we envision more than that in this renewed permit?
I don't anticipate any more at this time.
Okay.
In the past, there was one in San Francisco, but yeah. That hasn't been in operations.
Okay. I thought it was really clearly worded. And then under the Pinole, I thought that they had a good record on SSOs, and I like the way we described what they're doing in terms of preventative maintenance. Is there anything that we can do, given the reference in section F on page 9, to encourage their feasibility study for recycling potential? I just feel that this is something we typically talk about with almost every permit, and it seems like something they're thinking about, but is there anything, given the amount of money in the system over the next couple of years, that we can do to urge them forward?
I don't know of anything specifically that we can do with the city of Pinole. I just broadly overall with the nutrients watershed permit, we are having all the dischargers look at what their opportunities are for water recycling. And so there may be something that comes to light there.
Tom, did you want to add something?
Yeah, well, two things. One, building up what Bill just said, is part of a forthcoming report from all of the Bay Area wastewater treatment plants. We're going to see projected plan and in some cases conceptual new recycled water projects subject to resources and the like. But to be pretty clear, the available funding from infrastructure bill, et cetera, is actually already overcommitted. I mean, there's a waiting
yeah. list.
And so that's factored in actually in the consideration of the municipalities' plans that we're going to be getting, which have actually been funded or which are in the hopper to be funded versus the next generation. So we're definitely going to be giving this a lot of attention for multiple reasons, nutrient reduction just being one of them. So we will, in one way or another, keep you informed and determine whether what the extent the benefit of permit by permit attention to this merits consideration, okay, or it's we have a good plan overall. So we'll keep that in mind for okay items for you.
And then lastly, the Pittsburgh Generating Station, you had noted that they would be seeking coverage under the industrial stormwater permit. As that may take effect, and they are concurrently removing the fuel oil storage tanks, cleaning, closing, and demolishing these fuel oil tanks, do we as a regional board, once that activity is closed out, have any site responsibilities remaining at this facility?
Not that I know of.
Okay, so it's sort of a clean closure and gone, maybe?
yeah, maybe. My division only oversees the wastewater component. So yeah, as for the tank cleanups, yes, but I'm assuming that the toxics division is doing a good job and will do a cleanup.
It's just nice sometimes to think of all the different elements that this board brings to a given property, that at some point one walks away because the job is done. And if that's the case, it would be nice to celebrate. But with that, I have, Madam Chair, no further questions. And I just wanted to thank Bill and his team for their hard work in moving these through. Thank you.
Member Packer, I just want to let you know that what you've brought up is something that's an active dialogue that we have with staff in all our programs to make sure that the left hand knows what the right hand is doing and cross program understanding. So if we're touching a site, we're making sure we're giving them optimum attention and making sure we don't say something's okay when it's not. So it's an active challenge and we're getting better and better at it.
I have trust in that. Madam Chair, no further questions, and I'll move if you're ready.
I'm going to actually ask our executive officer just to give us a response to one last question. Tom Mumley referred to this, but Eileen, if you could please remind us that for all the NPDES permit holders around the Bay, we have asked for information on their climate change related plans, which includes both physical location of their facilities, but also things like recycling. Can you just remind us?
Yeah, so as part of the watershed permit, the nutrient watershed permits, there was a comprehensive look at each of the wastewater plants in the Bay Area and what their vulnerability is to sea level rise. And so we have all that information. That's already been submitted. And as part of issuing NPDES permits, Bill and his team have been asking them in the permits to make sure that they do a vulnerability study. And then in addition, what Tom was referring to as part of this second nutrient watershed permit that we're under right now, the recycled water study is going to be submitted to the Water Board in July of this year. And what it does, it looks at the opportunities for recycled water for the 37 POTWs. It lists what they're doing now and what's the potential opportunities and the potential timing for it. So that's going to be a great document for us to have, especially as all this funding, even though it's overcommitted, that we can see how we fit with the other funding and the other projects in the Bay Area and in the state.
Great. Appreciate that.
Can I just add and clarify that after the nutrients watershed permit, the first term of that and the climate change responses we got there, we also did a questionnaire that we sent to all the POTWs separately. And ask them to voluntarily give us information on a range of things. And so that's what we look to when we're doing those individual permits, where we summarize where they are in terms of climate change. We look at what they gave us and ask them to update that at that time.
All right, and do we expect a sort of a summary presentation to the board at some point on this information?
Yeah, so we're planning future updates on, we came last month on the nutrient strategy, and as part of the second nutrient watershed permit is this water recycle study. So we're thinking sometime later this year, we'd probably present the findings, because I think that's of interest. It's part of the governor's water resilience plan, is to have water recycling. And I think it was strategic of Region 2 to be asking for this information several years ago, and it's now due this July. So we can bring that back.
Wonderful, thank you. All right, before I get too far ahead of myself, let me ask for a motion on the consent calendar, please.
Madam Chair, I so move.
Great, and a second, please.
I'll second.
Board Member Kissinger, thank you very much. All right, Julie, can you call the roll on this, please?
Yes, ma'am. Board Member Young.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Aye.
Board Member Kissinger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hacker.
Aye.
And Chair Batty.
Aye. All right, we are moving right along here. We're going to go to item 5, which is an informational item and an update on the wetlands monitoring program. I'm going to ask our Executive Officer White to please move forward with this.
Great, thank you. So the Wetlands Regional Monitoring Program is a collaborative effort led jointly by the San Francisco Estuary Partnership and the San Francisco Estuary Institute. The goal of the Wetlands Regional Monitoring Program, or referred to as the WRMP, is to collect, synthesize, and communicate regional data to inform stewardship and adaptive management for conserving, restoring, and enhancing San Francisco Bay's wetlands. Water Board staff lead the Technical Advisory Committee and participate on the steering committee of the WRMP. Today, Sasha Harris-Lovett of the San Francisco Estuary Partnership will provide a presentation on how the RMP works, and Christina Toms, Water Resources Engineer in the Planning Division of our region, will provide a presentation on the WRMP Priority Modern Site Network. Now I'd like to turn it over to Javier Fernandez, who leads the Water Board's Planning Division, to say a few words.
Thank you, Eileen. Good morning, Chair Batty and members of the board. The idea of the Wetlands Regional Monitoring Program, which we'll refer to moving forward as Wetlands RMP or WRMP, was first conceived in the late 1990s by scientists at the San Francisco Estuary Institute and the San Francisco Bay National Estuarine Reserve Research Reserve. However, funding for the development of the Wetlands RMP was not available until 2018. Since then, Water Board staff have played an integral part in the development process, and our time has served as match for the EPA grant that has funded this process. Now I'll turn it over to Sasha, who will give the first presentation.
Thank you so much for having me. My name is Sasha Harris-Lovett. I'm the lead environmental scientist at the San Francisco Estuary Partnership, and happy to be telling you about the Estuary Wetlands Regional Monitoring Program today. Next slide, please. First, I'll start with a land acknowledgement to acknowledge that the San Francisco Bay is the unceded ancestral homeland of many indigenous people, including the Himron, Ohlone, Halkeen, Salkan tribe, the villages of Lashan, the Karkin, Muwekma, Ramaytush, Tamien, and Yokut Ohlone, the Amamutsin tribal band, the Bay and Coast Miwok, and the Patwin people. And the broader San Francisco estuary is also the homeland of the Plains Miwok, the Wapo, the Winton, and the Nisenan people. Next slide, please. So just to give you an overview, I'll first start out by giving a little bit of the context of the history of the San Francisco estuary's wetlands, and I'll give an explanation of why we're doing regional monitoring and how the Wetland Regional Monitoring Program works. So just for some historical context, pre-colonization, there were more than 540,000 acres of productive tidal marsh full of birds, bivalves, fish, and all sorts of biodiversity. By the mid-1900s, there more than 90% of that tidal marsh was modified, drained, or paved over. So much of that thriving ecosystem was dramatically reduced, and we saw reductions in a lot of those native species. Next slide. Currently, we have the Baylands Ecosystem Habitat Goal, which is to restore 100,000 acres of that tidal marsh. And really, this is an attempt to help restore that thriving ecosystem that was here, the resources that wetlands provide, including maintaining good water quality, shoreline protection, habitat for many, many different species. But to achieve this goal of 100,000 acres restored, we really need to advance the pace, scale, and effectiveness of wetland restoration. And we need to ensure that the wetlands we do restore aren't just completely drowned as sea levels rise. Next slide. So the idea of the WRMP is really to coordinate science regionally to be able to support wetland restoration and management. So this regional context will really help us answer big questions like how is climate change affecting wetlands in the Bay Area over time? These are questions that would be very difficult to answer with impossible to answer with the existing data that we have. The WRMP will also enable science-based decision-making for adaptive management. So we can see what we did is working and change accordingly. And then additionally, it will facilitate coordination of required regulatory monitoring. Next slide. So we are going to produce open source standardized data to inform this kind of regional adaptive management and it will result in more cost efficient monitoring. And an additional benefit is that this program is very cross-disciplinary. There are people from many different agencies, nonprofits, tribes working together. And we know that these kinds of social networks, that these rich teams really will help us solve big problems that our region faces, including adapting to climate change. Next slide. So here's our mission statement that Eileen shared at the beginning. The WRMP delivers coordinated regional science to inform stewardship, restoration, and adaptive management of the San Francisco estuary's wetlands. And that's a picture of our program plan, which we developed, which kind of lays out the course of the program. Next slide. So as Javier mentioned, in 2016, we started getting funding from the US EPA and in-kind funding to develop the program, including the science framework, a system for administration and governance, and a system for data management. And we got a second grant from the EPA in 2019 to continue that. Next slide. Currently, the program is funded through the EPA and the San Francisco Bay Restoration Authority, along with in-kind funding. And our current efforts are developing a monitoring site network, which Christina Toms will talk more about, and a comprehensive monitoring plan, conducting a regulatory needs assessment to understand the ways in which this program can support efficient regulatory monitoring, and to develop an equity and engagement strategy for communities and tribes to be part of the Wetlands Regional Monitoring Program. Next slide. So you can see on the map the WRMP's geographic scope. It's really the tidal wetlands around the bay. And these are our current goals to establish a robust and sustainable program. And that will include synthesizing existing old data sets with new data that we collect to answer some of our region's most pressing questions about our wetlands. And along the way, we strive to maintain an inclusive collaborative process. We have a very robust governance system that is really collaborative. Next slide. So the components of the WRMP are that we'll have a comprehensive science framework to guide the monitoring, which Christina will talk more about. We'll have an open data sharing platform, which is being created by our colleagues at the San Francisco Estuary Institute. And we'll have a monitoring site network of sites that will inform the regional data. Next slide. Just as a little overview of how the science framework will work. We start with guiding questions that our steering committee, which is made up of about 20 individuals from different regional, state, and federal agencies, along with tribes and nonprofit organizations. Our steering committee developed our guiding questions, and these were translated into more specific management questions and even more specific monitoring questions, which we can collect data to actually answer. And now we have work groups developing standard operating procedures for how to collect this standardized data in the most scientifically rigorous and efficient way. Next slide. So here's a picture of the WRMP data portal. It's geospatially organized. It currently contains the relevant existing data sets, and as the WRMP moves into implementation, it will house the new WRMP data sets as well. Next slide. Here's a picture of the WRMP monitoring site network around the San Francisco Bay and Suisun Bay, and it consists of benchmark sites, which we think of as like old growth wetland that can inform what wetland restoration projects may eventually look like down the line. Reference sites, which are wetlands that have been restored several decades ago, and current restoration sites that we can compare against the other two. And Christina Thompson will talk more in more depth about this as well. Next slide, please. Oh, and that's it. So thank you very much, everybody. And I turn it over to Christina Thompson.
Thank you, Sasha. And I think what we might do is hear from both of you and then take questions.
That sounds great.
Thank you.
All right, good morning, everyone. My name is Christina Toms. I'm an engineer in the climate change and TMDL section of the planning division. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about one of the latest technical deliverables of the San Francisco Estuary Regional Wetlands Monitoring Program, or WRMP, the Priority Monitoring Site Network. I serve as chair of the program's Technical Advisory Committee, or TAC, and Javier Fernandez serves as the Water Board's representative on the program steering committee, or SC. It's on. There we go. Okay. The Priority Monitoring Site Network reflects three key characteristics of the WRMP science process. First, the process to develop the network was highly collaborative and included input from dozens of scientists across over 15 different agencies and science institutions. Second, the monitoring network reflects a comprehensive set of criteria to prioritize the science necessary to answer key management questions with limited initial program funds. Finally, the network is built upon a progression of science products in order to form the foundation of a sustainable long-term monitoring program. Next, oh, there we go. The Wetlands RMP science team developed the Priority Monitoring Site Network through a measured collaborative process. After thorough discussion with the TAC in the spring and summer of 2022, the science team submitted an initial draft network to the Technical Advisory Committee and select interested steering committee members for review in October 2022. The science team incorporated the feedback from this initial review into a revised network that was submitted first to the TAC and then to the SC for their final review and approval. The TAC approved the network in December 2022, and the steering committee adopted the network in April 2023. With input from the steering committee, the TAC utilized a comprehensive suite of criteria to select which benchmark, reference, and project sites should be prioritized for monitoring by the program. First, the site should provide geographic coverage throughout the estuary, including in key subgradients of salinity and sediment supplies. Because the Wetlands RMP is intended to grow in scale and scope over time, it's not necessary to establish comprehensive monitoring networks within every single operational landscape unit in the near term. The WRMP can only establish itself as a stable long-term monitoring program if it demonstrates near-term effectiveness at addressing the key information needs of tidal wetland stakeholders. Second, the site should address the program's near-term science priorities and management questions, which Sasha previously described. Third, the sites should address the information needs of frontline, underserved, and environmental justice communities, who are uniquely dependent on the ecosystem services provided by the region's tidal wetlands. Fourth, the sites should leverage historic and ongoing monitoring to maximize the return on new monitoring investments. And finally, monitoring at the sites should support existing and planned tidal wetland restoration projects to inform adaptive management and future project design. There are a few key caveats I want to emphasize about the network. First, TAC and SC adoption of the network does not constitute a formal plan to initiate monitoring at any of these sites. It simply acknowledges that they collectively represent the best opportunity to implement the WRMP science framework. Discussions with site landowners and partners regarding access permissions, procedures, and related monitoring concerns are ongoing as part of the science team development of the monitoring plan, which I'll discuss further in a minute. Second, the Wetlands RMP is a monitoring program, not a research program. Due to resource limitations and to the highly modified and complex nature of the estuary, it may not be possible to monitor all program indicators with equal statistical rigor. As the program science framework matures, the TAC will advise the steering committee on data analysis and interpretation, including but not limited to situations where particular levels of statistical rigor are and are not necessary to address stakeholder information needs. Finally, the priority network does not preclude the use of the WRMP science framework to address other needs in regions or locations other than those prioritized for near-term monitoring. The network simply describes where near-term WRMP investment in the collection of new data and synthesis of existing data is most likely to efficiently and effectively address key near-term information needs. The site network reflects years of effort to build and refine the program science framework and builds upon a progression of Wetlands RMP science products. In 2020, the WRMP released its program plan, which describes conceptual models, guiding management and monitoring questions, near-term science priorities, a space-time framework, and a preliminary list of key indicators to monitor. In 2021, the science team designated benchmark sites and began to define standard operating procedures for how the program will collect, synthesize, and translate data into information for decision makers. In 2022, we expanded upon these earlier deliverables to produce the priority monitoring site network, which I just described. And in 2023, we're refining the program's geospatial data portal, preparing the Baylands change base map, and developing the program's first monitoring plan. The science team is continually engaging with the TAC and the steering committee to align our products with the most up-to-date science and the information priorities of the region's tidal wetland stakeholders. The next key step in the implementation of the Wetlands RMP is the development of the program's first monitoring plan. This plan will propose the what, why, how, where, and when of program monitoring over the very near term, or 1 to 2 year, and near term, 3 to 5 year timeframes. Its intended audience is the WRMP steering committee and program partners, including land managers, project funders, and regulatory and resource agencies. The plan will form the foundation of near-term WRMP implementation strategies for funding, administration, and regulatory alignment, as well as longer-term strategies to expand the program's scope and impact. First, the what. The plan describes the information products that the WRMP will develop to support science-based decision-making by the region's tidal wetland stakeholders. These products include interactive online maps of tidal wetland abundance, distribution, and condition, status and trends analyses of key wetland indicators across multiple scales of space and time, and assessments of how tidal wetland restoration projects are evolving towards target conditions. Next, the why. The plan describes the technical justification for proposed monitoring activities, including why the information products address the WRMP's guiding, management, and monitoring questions. It describes the information products that can be used by program stakeholders, including but not limited to land managers, project funders, regulators, and frontline communities. Finally, the how, where, and when. The plan describes how the program will develop the information products, including through standard operating procedures. Oops. I apparently lost part of my slides, including through standard operating procedures that will essentially describe how new data will be collected and how existing and legacy data will be synthesized, analyzed, presented, and communicated to a broader audience. But thank you again for the opportunity to describe how the Wetlands RMP Priority Monitoring Site Network reflects a collaborative development process, a comprehensive suite of science prioritization criteria, and the progression of the program's science products. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Great, thank you both. And I see the board members writing notes down, so I suspect there might be more than a few questions. So I think these questions will be both for Sasha and Christina. And for the board, what I'd like to do is, here's the order I'm thinking. I wanna start with Bill and then go down to Donald. And then I'm gonna go to Andy and then to board member Hacker. Board Member Kissinger, would you start us off with questions?
Great, thanks very much, Madam Chair. Well, this is a terrific program. It's, I guess one would say, you know, long overdue. It's, I guess one question just from that perspective, it's taken a long time to get it off the ground. Now that it is, you know, it's about to take flight, is the funding for this program secure? Is it, can we have confidence that we'll be able to continue to collect this data over the long term?
So we're really grateful to our funding partners. So far, we've received a tremendous amount of support from the EPA and the San Francisco Bay Restoration Authority. We are, and perhaps Javier and Sasha want to talk about this, investigating a variety of different future sustainable program funding models. We're looking at in-lieu fees. We're looking at continued grant funding. But perhaps Javier and Sasha want to talk a little bit about finance and administration?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So we are pursuing, as Christina said, several different lines of sustained funding. We're hopeful that the EPA and the Restoration Authority may be able to provide sustained funding in the longer term. There are potential other opportunities that we're investigating, but those are all still very much in development. So I think, you know, hopefully we'll have more to report in 6 months or a year. But I'll turn it over to Javier if he has anything else to add.
So Sasha talked about the near-term funding. We did develop a financial plan, you know, to try and address funding. The near term is the SF Bay Restoration Authority as well as EPA. Long term, we're looking at potential opportunities for private-public partnerships as well as potentially fees from permitting and a few other sources.
Yeah. And how deeply staffed will the program be? Will you, Dr. Harris Lovett, be full-time on this? Are you alone in this? How many people will be helping?
Yeah, there's currently a staff at both the San Francisco Estuary Partnership and the San Francisco Estuary Institute, and supported also with Christina Toms's in-kind time from the Water Board. So I think going forward, the level of staffing will really depend on the level of funding. We have a very experienced science team at the San Francisco Estuary Institute working now on the project, leading the work groups to develop the standard operating procedures and developing the data management portal. So I expect in the future, there will probably be less need to develop the data management portal. We'll just be maintaining it. The science products will be, you know, largely analysis and synthesis and not so much development. So I think the staffing will probably change over time. At the San Francisco Estuary Partnership, in addition to myself, we have another staff member who's working part-time on the Wetlands Regional Monitoring Program, as well as a California State Sea Grant Fellow.
Sounds like a dream job. Sounds fantastic.
I want to put some quick context on this, just to put relative to the San Francisco Bay Regional Monitoring Program, which essentially this board has direct control over, because it was built and initiated on by requiring our dischargers to monitor the far field effects of their discharge. So it's fully funded by regulated entities. And we're now at about approximately $4 million a year. The board has a key stake in the Wetlands Regional Monitoring Program, but we're not the only agency. But we don't have the suite of regulated entities like we do for discharges to the bay to compel them to do monitoring at that level. But we are looking at leveraging monitoring requirements of permits we do issue, which will be part of the pie, but it's really, it is a challenge to get the adequate amount of funding, but there's a bit of build it and it will come, but it has to be, but it's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing too. So we're fortunate we've been able to get grant money, and there may be some degree of sustained external funding, like that's noted from the Restoration Authority or possibly federally, but that's the challenge that the program is currently facing.
Yeah, I mean, my hope would be that it becomes as well established as the Bay Regional Monitoring Program is. Last question, just a tiny one. I'm sure it was somewhere in the presentation, but I struggled in vain. What does OLU stand for?
Operational Landscape
Unit. Okay. I did. It was in the program. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just for further clarification, it's Javier Fernandez. Operational landscape units were developed as part of a planning unit for climate adaptation in a project that we funded. Thank you. I blanked there for a moment. And so it's common. It's a term that's starting to be used more commonly for climate change adaptation, BCDC, Bay Area, regional collaborative, and other locations.
Great, thank you very much.
It first appeared in the SFEI report on the same, and I just encourage people, if you haven't taken a look at that in a while, to go. You can go to the SFEI website, and it's quite fascinating. Really good baseline material to understand all the work that's coming after it. And that was in
2019, the adaptation atlas was released, yes. And we're currently funding updates to that atlas.
Wonderful. All right. Thank you, Board Member Kissinger. We're going to go to Board Member Young.
Actually, my question was answered with Bill's information. So thank you.
I saw myself also crossing out questions as Board Member Kissinger started. So we're going to go to Board Member Gunther.
Thank you. I encourage all my colleagues to get familiar with OLUs because they are turning out to be incredibly valuable across a whole range of both political and scientific questions. Most recently, the modeling of sea level rise for the Bay that was delivered at BCDC. Turns out OLUs were just perfect for them to think about, Mark Stacey's group to think about it. Couple of questions. One has to do with the relationship between SFEP and SFEI in this. You've obviously there's a lot of collaboration. I tend to think of a project like this as being kind of in SFEI's wheelhouse. But obviously you're at SFEP. So can you tell me just a little bit about how you are envisioning or how this is developed and then going forward, how you envision it working?
Yeah, that's a great question. So currently SFEI, the team at SFEI and the team at SFEP are working very closely together, as I said. And the team at SFEI is really focused on the science framework development. SFEP side is more focused on kind of the program development, establishing the relationships necessary to build a robust steering committee, conducting the regulatory needs assessment to figure out how the program can best support efficient regulatory monitoring, conducting the equity and engagement assessment to understand how the program can support the needs of tribes and underserved communities. So I would characterize SFEP's role more as program development and SFEI's role more as science deliverable creation.
Great.
If I could just add a little bit, it actually shows one of the main differences between the Bay RMP and the Wetlands RMP. And Tom mentioned it. With the Bay RMP, we're the only regulator. And so we can do a lot of the coordination and make that happen. With the WRMP, because there's at least five, maybe six regulatory entities that are involved, there's a lot of coordination as well as multiple restoration practitioners and permittees that would be interested in this. It really needs a group like San Francisco Estuary Partnership that is very good at bringing people together in a collaborative manner to implement programs. And that is a critical role of SFEP in all this.
Well, I mean, I think you started your timeline in 2016, but this goes back much further than that, and people should understand that, that this has been under discussion for two decades at least in the region. Tom will remember exactly when it started.
Well, and I was going to draw to your attention the role you played in what was at the time we called the Clean Estuary Partnership, which was a separate sort of initiative where we brought some certain parties together to work with us to fund TMDL development. And Board Member Gunther had a key role in managing that program. But back there was a lot of process costs when we're trying to coordinate players to come to get consensus on what to do. And that's the reality of the challenge of building a program like this, is that there is a substantial amount of coordination and communication and fuel process costs that in competition with spending resources on actually collecting data that would be used to make decisions. And so it's not necessarily a dilemma, it's a challenge. And they're finding that balance where we get an agreement on how to generate resources and spend them, and actually then start generating the data and using them. Again, I feel so, we're so much easier at the Bay RMP level because of the direct nature that we have and taking the results and applying them to the board's decisions.
But yeah, and I think that's absolutely, and all of you should be congratulated on getting that kind of collaboration. I mean, it's not necessarily easy if you don't have the sword of the NPDES permit hanging over somebody's head. And and also your framing of in kind, I think you are underestimating both the actual value of that and how hard it is to acquire it and maintain its input. So I mean, I would encourage you to toot your horn a little louder there. The one last thing I just want to ask is, I was delighted to see that slide that started with guiding questions to management questions to monitoring questions. And this is one of the greatest challenges facing any monitoring program, is how you relate the things that you can actually measure to the things that people care about. And it is I want you to think about that slide in reverse, if you have not, which is how you generate meaningful management information from the stuff you actually measure, because that is not an automatic thing. It's something you have to figure out, and you have to get your stakeholders to agree upon it and agree upon it ahead of time. So everyone agrees, if our measurements show this, it means that. And that's a really, really important thing. And I would like to ask, Christina, you talked about the what, that we must have examples in the region where we have measured things in wetlands and we're using those to guide management right now. And I would encourage you to add something like that to your presentation that just gives an absolute concrete example of, here's how we're making decisions now and how we imagine in 2035, when we have 10 years of monitoring data, we're going to be able to influence decision-making. Because I think that it's underappreciated how complicated an effort that is to do, but you have examples now, so you can actually show it rather than just describe it with words like criteria and which are, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong, I love this stuff, right? And I spent a career doing this stuff, but it's not obvious to people. And I think that your program actually has more value, it has more legs, and it has more influence than you describe it right now by using more general terms. So I just want to say this is absolutely fantastic. This is the way, in fact, the only way I think we'll be able to figure out how climate change is affecting our wetlands and therefore affecting the resilience of our shorelines. And it's also going to be essential for figuring out how we make more of them effectively. And I know there's a lot of questions about how we do this, and we're learning methods and we're trying to find shortcuts because we don't have a lot of time to do this. So this is going to be essential. And are you guys planning to talk to BCDC about it soon?
So we do have a member from BCDC on the steering committee. That's Brenda Gayden. And we have somebody from BCDC also on the technical advisory committee.
Yeah, Todd Hallenbeck.
Well, no, I meant talking to the commission.
We don't have anything on the calendar, but that would be great.
Would you, can you like mention this to Larry or something? And let me know if you need my assistance. I think it would be great to have the BCDC commissioners brought up to speed about this as a group of people who are thinking a lot about resilience of the shoreline.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, based on your comment about the, you know, the management question, or sorry, the guiding questions, the management questions, and the monitoring questions, one of SFEP's roles going forward after the program is developed is really doing that kind of backwards translation of data into information that can really be used for decision making, and working with the decision makers to understand what the data means for them and how they might use it to inform their adaptive.
Yeah, and one example obviously is the indicators we've used for wetlands in this in the State of the Bay report. You know, we only spent years developing that, and the first tried it out in 2010, right? So it's, I think that those are just, it's so easy to forget the kind of language that you need to address people like us. Where you, because there's so much that goes in under the hood to get that information out, but you still need to make those very general kind of statements.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody. I'm going to move us along. Board Member Hacker, questions?
Just some quick ones. You noted in different places that this is all part of a data portal that will get updated. And I noted in the package that we worked with that you had referenced an interactive map of tidal wetlands. Is this information currently publicly accessible?
So the Baylands Change Base Map, that's going to be the interactive online mapping tool that's currently being produced by scientists at SFEI, and we expect to have that complete by the end of the year. We're still figuring out the details of what that online portal might be and how we make it queryable, how we make it accessible to both the general public and our research partners and monitoring partners, but that should be ready by the end of the year. And when that's available, we'll be happy to update the board on it and walk you through it.
I think it's a good opportunity to do external communication so that it's not just the board, but it's the larger set of community interests that we serve. But thank you for that. Secondly, completely separate from the universe that you described, I wonder if how this program, we'll just call it loosely, the program takes into account the various wetland mitigation banks that have been created within Board 2. Do we have any interaction with those and their health and their monitoring, which, you know, sometimes monitoring is part of setting up those banks. And sometimes, as we discovered more than a decade ago, those banks have not been kept up and they've been allowed to sort of not meet their functional needs.
Well, first, we don't have that many mitigation banks in our region, especially along the shoreline. I think we basically have two. And one of them has mostly completed their sales of credits. So we're really talking about one. And any future ones, they'll have their own monitoring requirements, okay, separate and above what the WRMP is doing. They can certainly download some of the data, like the mapping that's being done, in order to facilitate their reports. We learned a lot since the first one, Verdell Mitigation Bank, about what criteria, monitoring requirements, as well as performance criteria. And so we'll continue to use our experience from mitigation banks to improve the performance criteria as well as monitoring, but they're gonna have to have site-specific monitoring that demonstrates that they've actually improved conditions at the site. The other thing we learned was not to release credits too quickly. And I think that's a key part, where they get a little bit upfront for mitigation banking so that they can generate revenue, but then they're not allowed to sell any more until they demonstrate that they've met performance criteria. Then they can sell some more, and then there's a later stage where they do that again, and sometimes a fourth, but usually it's three stages.
something Board Member Gunther said made me think about your revenue question. As we go through various projects to improve shoreline resilience, there may be partners who are just partners for 2, 3, 4 years who could be part of the revenue stream as they undertake various shoreline resiliency projects. And they don't have to be in this game forever, but we, you know, we might be able to engage them for some measure of contribution as part of seeing those projects go in place.
I think that's part of the idea for the permit fees is potentially to have folks put into it. For instance, the baseline mapping is gonna be done over and over. So the first one's baseline map, then there'll be future mapping on intervals of 3 to 5 years. And if folks contribute money to it, then that would help fund the program and provide them with some of the monitoring data that they'll need as part of their project.
Thank you for your presentation. That's it, Madam Chair.
Great, thank you. I have just a couple of, I have two questions. Okay, first question is, I notice obviously your program is focused on the Bay. As a coastside, oceanside resident, I always have to ask, I assume Coastal Conservancy, Coastal Commission is doing something similar on the coastside. And can you talk about that and if there's any cross-fertilization?
That's a really great question. So I'm one of the folks that's helping to co-launch the California Estuary Monitoring Working Group, which was previously solely focused on the Bay Delta. It really was not focused on coastside issues. One of the things that we are hoping to do with the relaunch of that monitoring working group, and we're having a workshop later this year, is to discuss how these monitoring protocols that are being developed by the WRMP, protocols that are being developed by our partners in Southern California, how we can adopt these protocols and begin to roll them out statewide. We're beginning to have discussions with Region 1 about that. And so we're really just trying to bring the stakeholders together, begin to wrap our arms around what are the procedures and monitoring frameworks that are out there, and how can we make them applicable at a broader spatial scale? So that's absolutely in its initial stages.
That's a little disconcerting to hear, but thank you for the effort that it's in initial stages. Okay, my last question is for Sasha and Christina. You know, we started with the land acknowledgement in your presentation. Thank you. And we think about what has happened in the history of California with that community. 90% of our wetlands have been impacted. I don't have the scientific skill of Andy, but if I just do rough math, it's that, forget what you said, 100,000 acres is the goal. That's a very small percentage of what's been lost. And the recent Supreme Court decision about wetlands and the fires in the East Coast, fires in the West Coast. Here's my question. With all of this great work you're doing, just tell us what keeps you up at night these days. How do you put all this together and what keeps you up at night? Sasha, I'm going to ask you to go first.
Keep it under half an hour.
This is a 2-minute question. This is a 2-minute response, please.
You know, honestly, I think the Wetland Regional Monitoring Program makes me feel really hopeful. And I think that part of what makes me feel so hopeful is the social networks that I mentioned, the collaboration between and among agencies, nonprofits, and tribes. And I think that establishing those kinds of robust connections across different jurisdictions will really enable us to be better equipped to adapt to climate change, will help our region be more resilient in ways that we might not expect, that these connections might get used to address a pandemic or to address different challenges that we can't predict.
Wonderful. We might just stop there. Christina, do you have equally optimistic response? No, I was joking. Please, we would love to hear from you.
You know, I was very fortunate when I started my career 20 years ago. I worked on an earlier version of the WRMP called the Integrated Regional Wetland Monitoring Pilot Program. And many of the same folks that helped to launch that 20 years ago, I'm now working with as peers in the WRMP. And we are a stubborn bunch. And so I'm tremendously optimistic. There's a lot of folks that are looking to the WRMP to provide information to inform action. There's a lot of expectations. And I think that reflects a lot of trust. We have a muscle memory for interagency cooperation in the Bay Area that is really the envy of a lot of other geographies. I have folks from Puget Sound who called me recently who, you know, wish that we had, that they had something like this. And you know, there's, I think there's just a, with the co-op, between the cooperation, the collaboration and the stubbornness, I think we're gonna get this going and we're gonna get some great information and make some much better decisions in the future.
Awesome. Well, on behalf of the board, thank you both and thank everyone that's been engaged with this. We'll be excited to learn more about it as it moves forward. And thank you in particular for those optimistic messages. Thanks. All right, we're gonna move on to item 6 on our agenda, which is our chair, board members, and executive officers report. I can see that Sean McGuire is on the line with us, and we're gonna start with our state board liaison, Sean McGuire. Sean, are you there with us? There you are.
I am here. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good to see you all, and Chair Batty and board members.
You're following lots of optimism, so don't.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to react to all that. Unfortunately, my report didn't quite carry that momentum forward. So I'm going to do the best I can to move to you know, some of the challenges that we're facing. I just have actually a couple things I wanted to mention today, and most of it revolves around money. You all are probably aware of the state budget status. Currently, you know, the latest projected budget deficit was around $31 billion, and Governor Newsom issued his May revise proposal last month, and it did recommend some further reductions to different programs, particularly pots of funding for projects. For example, recycled water funding and some other areas that dovetail with some of the important work that we're doing at the water boards. And understandably so, you know, there's limited funds and I know tough decisions had to be made. Anyway, as you know, the next step is for the legislature then to work through the budget process, and they've been doing that. And as of, I believe it was Monday or late Sunday night, depending on how you're counting time, they settled on a proposal for the budget. And so now we're in this cycle of further negotiations that are happening at the Capitol. And so we'll see how things play out here and how the budget process resolves itself here over the next couple of weeks. But in all reality, there's just a whole host of issues. Notwithstanding, you may have heard of the governor's proposed infrastructure streamlining package, which included some CEQA reform proposals and other measures that, in his view, would help move much needed projects forward. It could include some water projects, could include some energy efficiency projects, transportation, and the like. So it was really broadly focused on infrastructure and moving those types of projects that might have been otherwise delayed through various regulatory processes to move more quickly than they would have otherwise. So that's, you know, all being tied in the budget discussions. So suffice to say, there's a lot going on there. And what I am committed to do here is come back, hopefully at your next board meeting, or you know, as soon as I can, to provide an update as to where everything lands in that space. So that's the budget update as I know it as of this moment. And moving to areas that are a little bit more under our control, but not completely, you know, it does come down to funding, right? So there's funding for our programs, there's funding for our resources and the much needed work that we all have to do at the state and regional boards. And I heard, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court decision was mentioned here, and you know, the Sackett case, which, because that translates to a narrower definition of waters of the United States in the eyes of the federal government. The good news is that we have solid coverage here at the state level with our Port of Cologne Water Quality Control Act. The bad news is that it means it's more work for our staff. And so there's always this push and pull as we do our important job of being limited resource-wise and you know, having too much to do and not enough folks to do it. So that's something I'm always aware of. And then on the other side, financial, so we're always looking for resources, but it doesn't always work out in the way we hope. On the other side, it's how do we fund the needed projects to prepare for climate change, to address aging infrastructure on the water side, to be resilient. And you know, a lot of that's acknowledged in the water supply strategy and the work that we need to do. A lot of that was acknowledged at the federal level and the bipartisan infrastructure law and, you know, various initiatives. I think there's broad acknowledgement that we have a lot to do here to ready ourselves for the coming decades and the challenges that we face from a water perspective. And so there's, you know, no clear solution yet there. There's no bag of money or, you know, pot that's going to just magically make all of these problems resolve themselves, but we do try and chip away at it. And one of those vehicles that we use is our State Revolving Fund program. And so that's an annual process where we take stock of what funds are there, what revenues are there, how much is the federal government contributing through their SRF contributions, you know, how much funding is in the program, how much is available for grant. And one thing we've learned over the past couple of years is that, you know, we were very excited for a while with the bipartisan infrastructure law, you know, with the state investments when there was a huge budget surplus. And so we actually leveraged, over-leveraged even our funding programs because we were so excited to get money out the door to fund these projects that we know are sorely needed. And so we had a record year a couple of years ago, issuing about $3 billion worth of funding, which was the most ever. And so what we're facing with now and this year is we're going through our intended use plan, our funding cycle is a reckoning of having to be a little bit more, have more of an austerity mindset and really bring in the funding that we're awarding with in line with the revenue and the reliable funding amounts in this program. So there's obviously, you might imagine a lot of many stakeholders are concerned with that. Of course, there's so many good projects out there and there's only so few dollars. So we're working through that. But, you know, I did take a look. So we're going through a workshop process on June 20th. We'll be discussing the intended use plans and then hopefully adopting that in July. And there are a few projects on there in the Bay Area. So I did look at the list to see if you had some on there. And one of the big shifts this year is to try and ensure that we can fund as many projects as we can, is looking at potentially a $50 million per project cap to allow the dollars essentially to be spread out as much as possible. So it's challenging because there's a lot of great projects out there that are quite large, actually, especially if you look on the wastewater side. I know, and you know, even stormwater projects, I know how large and costly those can be, especially these days. But we are trying to find a way to thread the needle there and ensure that we've got reliable funding for as many projects as possible. So those are actually just the items I wanted to touch on today. There's so much going on. And as always, I'm happy to answer questions either on this or any other topic that's coming before the state board that you'd like to discuss. But anyway, regardless, good to see all of you.
Thanks, Sean. Are there any questions for board member McGuire? Okay, Alexis and then Andy.
Sean, thank you for joining us. One of the things, it's interesting to think about a project cap, but I also think about the difficulty of funding stormwater projects versus the means available to fund wastewater projects on the project sponsor side, mm-hmm. given, if I remember correctly, Prop 218. And so it may make sense to where wastewater agencies and special districts can accommodate these capital expenses through their rate structure. you may want to think about some flexibility for stormwater projects where they don't have other ways of raising revenue. But thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, that's a very well taken point. And we are also going through our state revolving fund policy update process right now, which is a separate document and separate adoption. And so that's a good point. I will take that under consideration. Thanks.
Board Member Gunther.
Thanks, John. I appreciate the update. Just very quickly, and it's a very general question, and if we don't have I don't know what you say now, but in the context of our discussion of wetlands and of the recent Supreme Court decision, there's a major wetland emerging in the Central Valley in Tulare Lake. And I'm wondering whether as a board, you have all been thinking about this, or is this something that's, you know, maybe you're gonna discuss more in the future or whatever, but I'm just interested in how this is being addressed in the context of both flooding and wetlands emergence and all.
That is a very good question. That is one I would have to get back to you on. Certainly our response most recently has been mitigating the flood impacts to communities, the impacted levees and agriculture, impacted transportation, trying to find ways to promote groundwater recharge in that area. But your comment is well taken. Certainly there was a lake there, and certainly it has reformed in some respects. So that's something I will look into a little bit more. Thank you for that comment.
Thank you, Board Member McGuire, for joining us today. And we're going to go on to the State Board, the Regional Board member reports. Sean, good luck in Sacramento. Thanks again for joining us. Board Member Kissinger, anything to share today?
Nothing for me.
All right, Board Member Young.
I attended the ABAC meeting, but there's nothing substantial for us. They are updating their fees, which I don't know if that's really a big deal for everyone, but it was a long discussion over a few meetings.
Okay.
So that will be coming out in the region. And they did actually approve, I believe, about $900,000 for the San Francisco Estuary Blueprint. I think the US EPA gave maybe $900,000 or so.
Wonderful.
So that's a report for ABAG.
Wonderful. Thank you. Board Member Gunther?
Yeah. Board Member Balin attended the BCDC meeting. So I don't have anything to report there. For our little climate change discussion, one thing I would just point out is that for many of us, we now have people who live in the East Coast who are having a visceral experience with climate change. And it's very interesting to see how that influences how people discuss it. And it's an opportunity for all of us who understand maybe some of the technical issues to link it to the experience that people are having and help them understand. I saw a fascinating statistic, which is that 60% of the wildfire smoke exposure occurs to people who live in states that are not where the trees are burning, which is an interesting way to think about the impact of fire.
Interesting.
I think you were expressing Schadenfreude just now.
All right, Vice Chair Hacker.
Nothing, Madam Chair.
All right, I'm gonna report out on just one item. I participated in and helped host a meeting of an organization called Planet Women. Board Member Hacker was actually there as well. And it is it's a nonprofit that was formed just a few years ago, but its goal is to support women moving into more executive roles at environmental organizations in the primarily in the nonprofit sector right now, but also looking at government and private sector in the future. And like Christina and Sasha, it was full of optimism and energy for the future. And so it was really a pleasure to be part of that and to hear their thoughts about how we will tackle this. I think that's it for me today. I'm gonna turn it over to Executive Officer White.
Thank you so much. I just wanted to follow up on some previous comments made by Board Member McGuire and others regarding the Supreme Court decision. And just let you know that although we're extremely disappointed in the decision and the adverse impacts it will have nationally, it only narrows the scope of the federal jurisdiction and doesn't weaken California's more stringent wetlands protection. Because under the state's Porter Clone Water Quality Control Act, as you know, the state and regional water boards retain the regulatory authority for protecting wetlands. Having said that, how it will impact workload is the ruling will require California to rely on its own regulatory wetlands protection programs and deprive us of the expertise previously provided by the Corps of Engineers. So we're working very closely with State Board and the Office of Chief Counsel just to see about what the extra workload will be. But we are very lucky to be in California. That's all I have. Thank you.
Yes, please, Board Member Hacker.
With regard to the lamentable Sackett decision, I know we feel like we can operate in California as an island with our Porter Cologne protections, but I do have the sense that for any of the upper basin states that are discharging to the Colorado, which is so critical to Southern California, there are no protections for California for the water we take in from the Colorado per the upper basin states. I don't expect Oregon is going to behave badly as a neighbor, but I do think that we need to be very mindful, given the stresses that exist on the Colorado, that there are no particular protections to be found in the upper basin states.
Yes.
Great. Thank you, everyone. All right. We're going to adjourn the meeting in just a minute.
Before we do,
sure.
I guess I just wanted to ask a couple questions about Marinwood and the report.
I apologize. Yes, please.
And I just wanted to understand one piece. It hadn't jumped out at me until I read the report, which was the submission of the effectiveness report that was submitted in May. And in the subsequent comment that they're due June 30th of each year. So is that to suggest that the report that was submitted on May 12th this year was the June 30, 2022 report? In other words, 11 months after the fact?
Yeah, there we go. No, this report that was submitted in May was a follow-up from last year's report. They submitted that last year. Our staff person, Gleed Carlton, had some questions about it. And the proposal was to revise it last fall and include some monitoring data. Then there were some delays. So the submittal of this report is essentially last year's report. They did submit last year's report on time. We just wanted some more information in it.
Got it. And were we satisfied with the report that was submitted last month?
Yes, yes. And we're encouraged even because of the proposed activities to do more soil vapor probes to figure out if there's any real risk or threat to the residential community to the west of the street was included. Also more injections for the groundwater plume and some additional monitoring wells. So it was very encouraging.
Great. Thanks very much.
Great. Any other questions before we? Okay, great. The board will not be meeting in closed session today. This concludes our meeting. Our next meeting is scheduled for July 12th at 9 o'clock here in this building. I do want to mention before I close out that we are not going to be having an August meeting. I think the board members are aware, but to make everyone aware, no meeting in August will resume in September. And that will be it for today.
Well done.